So today is Wednesday, March 10th, right, 2010, and I'm Rick Hansen, obviously, and I wanted to talk tonight about mindfulness. And if you'll forgive me, very often we start our evenings here with a question and then some discussion bubbles up, and I'm particularly fond of that because all kinds of stuff comes out that's usually the exactly right thing, you know, to talk about. On the other hand, tonight I have a fair amount of material I'd like to get through. And also, I'm a little under the weather. I've been grappling with some stomach crud, so I'm going to try to end quite promptly at 8:30. Don't worry, I'm beyond the stage where you fear you'll have a sudden accident and need to bolt out of room. So I really am stable, but have no fear in the front row, you know. But anyway, that said, I'll try to end really quite promptly at 8:30, and if you'll help me, I'll try to get out fairly quickly thereafter. So I really want to talk about mindfulness, and as you probably know, or if you haven't been here before, I'll tell you right now, we're focusing this year on mindfulness as one of the three fundamental pillars of practice laid out in the path by the Buddha. The other two pillars are virtue and wisdom. So if you put those three together, virtue, mindfulness, which is often translated as concentration, and wisdom, you really have the foundation of any kind of path, really, of contemplative practice, and more broadly, spiritual awakening, personal growth, even healing from distress and dysfunction. And to make a point in passing that I make in the beginning of my book, it's interesting that those three pillars of practice also seem to correspond quite closely, and probably not coincidentally, to three fundamental functions in your nervous system and my nervous system, which is to say, regulation, learning, and selection. In other words, regulation is very close to virtue, in which we restrain what's unwholesome, and we try to stabilize our balance in the face of a changing world. Learning is very akin to mindfulness, as we'll talk more about this. Mindfulness and focal attention is kind of like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. If you received or had a chance to look at the Just One Thing column that I pushed send on this morning, I use that analogy in that column, in that, you know, attention illuminates what it rests upon and also sucks it into your brain, right? In other words, the brain is always firing and therefore wiring together, but it really, really turbocharges the formation of neural structure for what's in the field of awareness and in particular what's in the field of focused attention. So gaining greater control of attention is a premier way to promote learning for better and for worse, or hopefully for better. In terms of the development of neural structure, because that's what learning is in its biological sense, at least insofar as the nervous system is concerned. And then, of course, there's wisdom, which I think the Buddha described it in one of his teachings as choosing a greater pleasure or over a lesser one. In other words, as other people have noted, it's easy to choose good over bad, right? The tough choices in life are good over good, right? One good or another good. And I think wisdom a lot is a matter of giving over to the best parts of ourself and giving over to our best purposes and then letting those live through us and live as us, and we live as them as well. And so that's wisdom, which is really a matter of selecting. And that's a fundamental function within the nervous system. So you see that interesting parallel, don't you, between mindfulness, between virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, and regulating, learning, and selecting in the nervous system. It's probably no coincidence that they match quite closely together. So in this year of practice, in general terms, we're going to explore mindfulness, and apropos of that, it seemed reasonably appropriate that I would take a crack at defining that term, which has gotten a lot of currency these days. I guarantee you, somewhere in America, earlier today, in some Fortune 500 company, if not in dozens of Fortune 500 companies, there were trainings in mindfulness as a form of stress management or paying greater attention to the inner wisdom of the emotions in the body to be a better salesman or saleswoman or supervisor or coworker. Mindfulness is really spread out, including in hospitals around the world, and even in classrooms, there's a growing attention to it. So I think it's really important to try to be clear about what we mean when we're mindful so that we know what we're aiming for. Here we have this very powerful tool, this spotlight, this vacuum cleaner. What is it? And by understanding what it is, we can then understand better what the factors are that promote it and then develop that capacity increasingly in our own lives with growing benefits for ourselves and other people around us. Okay? All right. And so I hope to talk about this, and I'll pause for breath occasionally and take some questions. And also feel very free to pop your hand up and ask about something I've said so far, or comment on it as well. Okay? One of my hopes here, increasingly, is maybe even as we get to perhaps a larger realm, I do have a feeling that we're on a growth curve and we'll probably outgrow this lovely space. You know, all things, you know, come to an end, of course, even really sweet ones. But my hope is to have more of a participatory quality to it. You know, there is a place for someone speaking and people listening and then commenting, but the more we can function almost in a circular kind of way, you know, the happier I'll be about that. So that said, I'd like to talk about at least what I think mindfulness really means. Okay. So if I were to come up with a sort of a one-sentence definition for mindfulness, it would be sustained non-preferential presence. In other words, the root of the Pali word for mindfulness, Pali being the language of the earliest surviving written record of the Buddha's teachings, and certainly a language that was current in his time. Pali is to Sanskrit what Low German is to High German. And the two languages are really quite close together. The Pali word for mindfulness is sati. So you've probably encountered that word before in the Buddhist realm, if you've been in that realm somewhat, sati. And the root of the word sati is memory or recollectedness. So if you think about it, mindful is a quality of sustained recollectedness. Right? That's what we do when we're mindful. I think of mindfulness as having three fundamental attributes to it. In other words, if you think about it, attention is distinct from mindfulness. At any moment in time, attention, which is to say kind of what's under the spotlight in this larger stage of awareness, can move from thing to thing to thing, which doesn't necessarily mean we're mindful. Right? Haven't we had the experience sometimes in situations where our attention feels like it's skittering around like a spotlight on speed, right? We've got attention. We're being attentive moment to moment to moment to varying things under the spotlight, but one would not say there's much mindfulness there. What is it that distinguishes mindfulness from ordinary attention? Also, for example, a person can be intently focused without the spotlight flipping around, let's say on something that they're very angry about or very obsessed with or very frightened about. And yes, attention is captured by that thing, but we also wouldn't necessarily say that the person is mindful when their attention is hijacked or sucked into the black hole of some stimulus. What is it about mindfulness, again, that distinguishes mindfulness from that kind of attention? Mindfulness is a form of attention, but it's a very particular form of attention combined with a kind of contextual attitude. So I'd like to offer what I think are three fundamental attributes of mindfulness. And if they're present, mindfulness is present. I think they're necessary and sufficient. I'll go out on a limb here. In other words, if you don't have all three, mindfulness is weakened. And if all three are present, mindfulness naturally emerges. So the first of the three, in my own view, is presence, which is a wholehearted, embodied attention. We're present with something. So let's pick something simple. Let's say we want to be mindful with the sensations of breathing, breath after breath from beginning to end. Or, to pick a harder example, let's say that we want to remain mindful of what our partner is saying and experiencing as our partner brings a complaint about us to us. That's a little more challenging, isn't it? So let's keep both examples in mind, all right? The simple case is mindfulness of the breath, sensation after sensation, breath after breath. The other one is, you know, when your partner has a beef. All right, I know those conversations, you know, with my wife, where something's wrong and it's probably me. All right, we've all been on the receiving end, and that's the tricky. That's a higher bar in a way. So, okay, so to The first characteristic, I think, is we're present. We're there. We've showed up. You know, we're shown up. That's right. We've shown up for the moment. We're there and our bodies are there. There's an embodied quality to our presence and there's a wholeheartedness to it. Okay? There's a lot of nice things that wholehearted, embodied aspect of mindfulness brings into sustaining our attention to something, and it helps us stay there longer. When our body's in the game, it's kind of like the old phrase, having skin in the game. You know, you got some skin in the game. Not literally here in the sense of, you know, losing a little blood for something, but we're invested in some sense in sustaining that presence with whatever it is. So that's the first attribute of mindfulness. The second attribute of mindfulness, in my own notion, is spaciousness, which means an openness, an inclusiveness, a non-preferring. All right? You've heard me use the expression in here, which I've borrowed from other teachers of my own, of the field of awareness like the sky, boundless, open, limitless. There's a kind of spaciousness. There's a non-preferring, you know, what arises, arises. What passes away, passes away. There's an allowing. It's not merely a kind of passive acceptance of, oh well, screwed once again by this thought, here it comes. You know, it's not resignation or defeat. It doesn't have that kind of negative quality to it, but it has a kind of friendliness, a kind of warm-heartedness toward whatever moves through the field of awareness, including things that are uncomfortable. Okay. Spaciousness, openness. One of the phrases that's used is choiceless awareness. There's no choosing of what arises. Now, one can deliberately direct mindfulness in certain areas or directly surface things and therefore choose certain things to come back into the field of attention that one is investigating. Let's say there is some choice, but very often when one is a kind of completely relaxed, open, spacious awareness, which is one of the major types of meditation, a good term for that is indeed, I think, choiceless awareness. The third attribute of mindfulness that I think is really necessary is this quality of recollectedness, which for me involves persistence of presence. If you think about it, we're all mindful many times a day for 2 or 3 seconds at a time. The art, isn't it, is to sustain mindfulness for longer periods of time and to have more mindful moments each day. I think often about the classic and lovely and hopeful and inspiring phrase, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening. In other words, the notion that, or as someone else said, moments of enlightenment many times a day. It's traditionally said that in any moment where there truly is no greed, hatred, or delusion, broadly defined, arising in the mind, at that moment we have the mind of a Buddha. Right? The difference is the stability and profundity, or the stability and depth of that moment. So we have many moments of mindfulness. But I think practice a lot is about taking these wonderful little pearls amidst lots of blank spots, you know, in the beaded chain, and increasingly stringing the chain of the seconds of our life so that it's pearl after pearl after pearl after pearl after pearl of mindful presence. And obviously as well, virtue and wisdom. All right. So it's interesting to think about recollectedness both in terms of the experiencing of it and a kind of neurological reflection about it, in the actual experience of this sustained recollectedness. Again, remembering that the root of the word mindfulness in Pali is memory, that there's a kind of reverberation or resonance that's kind of circular in terms of our sense of really being there with whatever it is that we're with. There's a kind of knowing of whatever it is, and a knowing simultaneously of the knowing itself. So in psychological language, there's a certain metacognition of, you know, there is knowing, and this knowing is ongoing. There's a going on being of the knowing. There's a going on being in the great British child analyst Winnicott's phrase, there's a going on being of mindful presence. And I think in terms of the brain that, you know, the field of awareness is kind of a reverb loop, you know? In other words, we're basically parts of the brain represent other parts of the brain to the brain. And, you know, it has a recursive, Gödel-Escherbach kind of circular quality in the brain in ways that, I want to be clear, we don't understand well at all. I don't want these fancy terms to make it seem like I know what I'm saying. Because I mostly don't, although I have some intimations that there's something about this circular, recursive reverberation that seems fundamental to mindfulness in some way. Now, it could be a reverberation on a time scale of about a second or a second and a half or 2 seconds, but that's a long time in the brain when you've got neurons firing 5 to 50 times a second and neural assemblies forming in about 2 to 3 tenths of a second, connecting with each other and fading away before the full second has elapsed. You know, it's that quick as these eddies of neural coalitions form in the brain and therefore generate thoughts in the mind, which then fade away because everything is impermanent, including, you know, what arises in the mind. But during that time, I think it's quite possible that there are circular processes of information sharing that create this kind of reverberating, recollected, sustained, persisting quality that's at the heart of mindfulness. Okay. So however it happens, just to recap, I think if one looks closely, one sees in mindfulness that there are these sort of three essential conditions for sort of the full blossoming, if you will, of mindfulness, which is to say presence, spaciousness, and recollectedness. And then maybe what I'll do, if I could, is I'll just conclude by talking about 4 supporting conditions, and then let's sort of open this up for discussion, wrapping by 8:30. All right? Okay, so far? Okay. And as we do this, why don't we do a little experiential activity to bring this conceptual stuff down to earth. For the next, I'd say, minute or so, how about trying to sustain mindfulness to your breath, beginning to end, while simultaneously opening out as spaciously and widely as you can to whatever else is flowing through awareness. And then I'll ding the gong in a minute or so. And then and as you do this, try to have some kind of gentle awareness in the back of your mind about the aspect of presence. Am I present here? When am I really present with the breath, really intimate with it, really sinking into it like someone settling into a warm bath? And when have I gone away? Second, when is there a spaciousness, an openness, a yielding, an allowing, a kindness to what's flowing through the mind? And when is there tightness and contraction and constriction? And then third, when is there a sustained quality to the absorption versus skittery attention that, you know, can track 2 to 3 breaths in a row and then goes away? Okay, so let's try this. And how about we do it for 2 minutes even? Okay, let's do this. Eyes open or closed, just staying with the breath. How about a couple just brief comments, if you could, because I will open up more for discussion in a moment. Just a couple brief comments about what, if anything, you noticed about presence, spaciousness, and recollectedness. Yeah, please.
I found that I was expecting the thoughts would come up, and then just recognizing them instead of letting them come and take you away.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. You know, and I was expecting the mind to be busy. That's a wonderful supporting factor. Thank you. Okay, a couple more. Yeah, please.
My reaction to it was like my meditation practice. So I'm wondering, is mindfulness and meditation one and the same thing?
That's great. Let's flag that question and come back to it, okay? I think my short answer is I think there are two circles that overlap. I think you can, I'll just say it right now. I personally think there are lots of ways to be mindfulness outside of formal practice. Traditionally, the Buddha recommended that we be mindful all the time. Walking, I mean, he has a long list that includes defecating and eating and talking. Talking is one of the hardest things to sustain mindfulness during. He even says one should practice so intently that one is aware upon waking whether one awoke upon an inhalation or an exhalation. That's a high bar. And the same with falling asleep. Although I have known people on retreat, deep in practice, who actually can register that. And then on the other hand, I think there are forms of meditation that probably require some basic kind of mindfulness to work, but are mostly not about that. They're about other kinds of things. Sure. Okay, maybe a couple more. Yeah, what did you experience especially with regard to these three things?
I find when I meditate, or when I was meditating on the breath, I have no trouble concentrating on it. And I have no trouble being mindful of what's going on around me. It's when I try to identify what's going on around me. That's what interferes with my being present with the breath. Yeah.
You mean like label it in some way?
Yes. Instead of just hearing a sound, I'll say, oh yes, someone is coming in from the right side of the room and going to the left. Or I hear a bird and that sounds right. Like this kind of a bird. So I'm identifying the sounds that I hear or the odors that I smell at the same time that I'm breathing, and it interferes. It's very difficult for me to do both.
Yeah. Little suggestion, maybe not. I think one of the tricks is to not have things mean anything and to truly sit in not knowing. You know, and not try to stitch the contents of mind together. I've actually been experimenting with that as a practice, and maybe at another meeting we have, I'll talk about lateral circuits of the brain versus medial, and this thing that happens when you're out on the side of the circuits where you just, you don't know, and you don't need things to connect. You know, Sogyi Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher, had a nice line. He said that, you know, there's no problem with thoughts, right? In other words, there's no problem with the stuff flowing through our head. The problem comes when we glue things together. It kind of makes sense. And that idea of just relaxing and not gluing can probably be quite helpful.
But okay. Are you being mindful?
Yeah.
If you don't identify what it is you're hearing?
Yeah, I think what one's mindful of is the experience of mindfulness, grounded probably in something neutral, like and pleasant and fairly benign, not just neutral but benign, like the sensations of breathing, and a growing sense of tranquility. There's this presence with the open field without particular engagement, even to the level of verbal labeling with what's moving through the field. No, one more. And then I want to do these four supporting factors. Yeah.
I guess this would come under the area of presence. There's more of a sense of being in touch with emotional quality to my state. And being open to where that went.
Yeah.
Or being present at the same time, being present going to memory, but there's a current emotional state. Yeah.
I think that may well be that when we're present, especially with this more embodied quality, naturally we're more in touch with ourselves and therefore more in touch with our emotions perhaps as well. Okay, great. So you can see that these kind of three dimensions or aspects. I encourage you to explore them. I noticed just sitting here, because I have a lot on my mind these days, that I could do in the presence part and the spaciousness, but the continuity of recollectedness during the 2 minutes trying to track the time was fairly skittery. And that's just honesty with oneself. And it really varies, you know, what is the case. But we want to be honest with ourselves about what is the case in terms of these three dimensions. And which, for example, it's good to develop. Like for a lot of people, developing the sustained recollectedness is ground zero. Because it's hard to have the other two if you can't sustain, you know, breath after breath after breath, a certain continuity of concentration. Which is one reason why traditionally, you know, continuity of concentration is actually taught before insight practices. In the West, because of course we want to get the prize without doing our homework. We want dessert without having to eat our spinach first. We went right to insight and these radical transcendental teachings. But the foundation of those practices, so that those insights are actually embodied and felt and, you know, usable, is learning to really steady the mind. So whatever it is for you of those three, think about what might be worth developing and paying some attention to and focusing on, even for a few weeks or a few months in your own practice. Okay, just I'll keep going, actually, these four supporting conditions, then we'll really open it up. So four supporting conditions, briefly here, that I think are, in my own experience, really useful. I don't think they're the only four supporting conditions. I think there probably are others, but these are also traditionally described. One is diligence, that we bring a certain kind of effort to it, you know, a certain muscularity, a certain sincerity, that we're just with it, we stay after it. You may recall that in the Buddha's instructions for the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta that we went over a bit and we're going to get back into it, he talked about diligence as a kind of as a foundation of mindfulness practice. It doesn't mean we're harsh with ourselves, doesn't mean we're beating ourselves up with a whip, whatever, but there is a kind of sincerity. Yeah. You may know, you may have heard me talk about these four words that are traditionally used to describe a sincere and an accomplished practitioner, ardent, diligent, resolute, and mindful. And what's one of the four? Diligent. Ardent means heartfelt, diligent, resolute. Those two kind of go together, and mindful. All right, the second quality that is traditionally described is clearly comprehending. In other words, it's kind of easy to go into a New Age blur. How many of you have ever had that meditation where you're sort of kind of mellow and spacey, and it's kind of mushy, and it's nice. Hey, it's better than kicking the dog, okay, right? But it doesn't have a quality of clear comprehending where there's a knowing. Now, the trick, really important about clearly comprehending, is not to tip into the pitfalls of getting caught up in, for example, clearly comprehending that the sound is due to the fact that this person is moving across the room and the floorboards are jiggling, and isn't it interesting, they don't really have floorboards, and this is an old house, and, you know, we're clearly comprehending, but it's problematic, or getting caught up in words. That, too, is a problem. A second major pitfall around comprehending, or the notion of knowing, is to presume that there is a knower. And this is a bit of a tricky one. But often, sometimes, if we get caught up in clearly comprehending, we presume that there is a self, an I, who is doing the clear comprehending, rather than there is comprehending. There is the intention to comprehend. There are factors that make comprehending stronger or weaker, but there's not necessarily, you know, a one who's doing the comprehending. And that is a whole can of worms I do not want to get into tonight. But it is a pitfall to be aware of. And then the last pitfall related to clear comprehending is the dualism that sometimes arises in it, where there's a sense of a knowing and the known. And that's, I think, an intermediate step that happens. It's okay that it happens. But as the mind gets quieter and quieter and quieter, and then we take that quality increasingly with us, there is simply things happening. There is, you know, awareness and its objects arising together. I think of it as awaring, you know, awaring with objects arising together. So there isn't necessarily that dualism of knowing and known. All right? So clearly comprehending. In other words, we're not stupid. We're not spaced out. We're not drugged or delirious when we're being mindful. There's a lucidity. You know, and the Tibetans talk about this really quite well. There's a brightness of the mind. There's a lucidity. There's a clarity there. Okay? And then third supporting condition for mindfulness, I think, is an ethical purpose. In other words, a burglar is very attentive. Okay? A sniper is very, very attentive. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're mindful in the Buddhist sense or the contemplative sense. And I think that there is something about being there with our whole heart to a good end that really supports mindfulness. Right? And then last, to use the Buddhist phrase, we are there without longing and dejection. In other words, what he means by that is that we are doing this sustained, embodied, spacious presence in which we are intimate with whatever is flowing through awareness without grasping after, chasing after that which is pleasant and desirable, or resisting and struggling with that which is unpleasant and awakens fear or anger. Okay? The one is longing, the other is dejection, you know, in his phrasing. Instead, there's a growing tranquility, and that's why I think Joseph Goldstein and others have really pointed to tranquility, a growing peacefulness to the extent that one can find it authentically, not forcing it, but authentically allow. I think of the sediments suspended in the pond of the mind, gradually kind of settle down, and the pond gets clearer and clearer as we relax and continually let go and let be and allow and gently intend into a growing peacefulness and spaciousness and ease. As that happens, there are supports for mindfulness. Because, for example, it's hard to be mindful when we're stressed out, jacked up, revved up, or, you know, upset about something, right? One can, but it's harder. So to find a place where we're not caught up in longing for various things or dejection about other things, then we're much more able to be mindful. And then the last thing I'd like to say about mindfulness in passing before opening it up is kind of I want to pull a wheelie here, all right? And I prefer not to get too caught up in it because it's more conceptual than anything else. But I just want to say that normally when we speak of mindfulness, we're really talking about, we're locating this open, spacious presence with, you know, information moving through. We tend to locate it within an individual's head or within an individual, within a particular body-mind. And it's very interesting to start opening up a consideration of mindfulness as a recursive recollectedness that involves sustained, spacious presence that actually occurs in the field between two people, or in the field in a larger group in which there is that spacious, sustained presence with what's happening, including ultimately in larger networks of information sharing, like even in the World Wide Web. And it's interesting to play around with the notion of mindfulness and the conditions that support mindfulness in that larger context. But I wanted just to leave you with that thought, which is an emerging reflection for me. Okay. Thank you for your mindful attention. I can really feel the weight of it. Comments, questions? What? All the way in the back, please.
I have actually two, because the last thing you said just brought something up. But the first one is, I don't quite understand the word, your use of the word recollectedness, because mm-hmm. to me that brings up the word recollection. And usually when I'm meditating, I'm trying to let go of yeah. every second as it passes, and recollection, it seems to imply to me that I'm going to go back.
Yeah.
And so maybe you could explain that word. And then the other question is, one of the reasons I really like your teaching is because it's so grounded in neuroscience. Mm. And then when you say, let's look at the interaction between two minds in a room, do you have any physical ideas about how that might actually be occurring in a physical sense?
Okay. So to the first one, yeah, it's a wonderful question, because if we get caught up in our memories, then we've lost mindfulness. We're sucked in, right? We don't have that kind of open, stable presence with whatever's there. It's just that I and other people have tried to understand, why did the Buddha use a word that's rooted in memory for mindfulness, let's say, of the sensations of the body or the feeling tones of experience, is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And I suspect my own experience is that when I don't mean recollecting, You know, it's not like we're looking over our shoulder and trying to remember what just happened, because I think then people can tie themselves in knots. It's not about that. I think it's more like when we're really present with what's happening, even though now is razor thin, supported somehow, I mean, in the reverberation loops, I think, in the nervous system, the experience of this moment is actually about half a second to a second and a half long, right? It doesn't have that feeling. It kind of is fading at the entry into this moment, and it's emerging at the entry into the next. People have talked about the duration of the subjective moment, which isn't just vanishingly thin, you know, on a, you know, picosecond or whatever, you know, a billionth of a second. Nanosecond is a billionth of a second. So, and I think that resting in that space intimately, which is about maybe half a second to a second and a half long, and I suspect actually that that space gets narrower as people deepen absorption, but there still is that sense of a sustained sense of what's happening. I think that's what I'm trying to get at with what I think is meant by recollectedness. And ultimately the question is, what in the world did the Buddha mean by recollectedness? And beyond that, what does it mean to you to have that quality of recollectedness? But I also mean it as something of a proxy for continuity. Continuity. You know, also just not forgetting. That's the other side of it. Don't forget. You know, be here. Don't forget. You know, no moments of mindlessness. Like in a sense, when we're mindless, we have forgotten something. And then with regard to the interpersonal field, I don't want to get too sucked into that. It's just what I mean by that is not anything in terms of energy transfers, or which may well be the case, you know what I mean? But I really mean that the dyad itself, or triad, or family, or group, or nation, or World Wide Web, potentially, can be a field in which there is a reverberating presence with what is there. And that's all I'm just trying to say. And opening out to that notion, I actually have found quite interesting. Okay. Couple others? Yeah, right there. You were patient. Thank you.
A couple of years ago, I went to Bali, and I had this experience with this healer who did this purification ceremony. And the result of it was I had 3 days of being more present than I've ever been in my life. It was really boring. It was very strange. It was like blank mind, not grabbing onto much of anything. It was nice being in nature, you know, because I could actually, you know, kind of look at things and feel it and just... But I was going, I wouldn't know what to do with my life, with myself, with... And I wish I had had somebody to consult with at that time, because it was nothing like anything I'd ever experienced, because I go through long periods each day like that, where nothing... would grab me. It was so in the moment. There was great joy at times, but most of the time it was just not much of anything. And right. If this is what we're after...
Really? What in the world am I pitching here?
Boring.
Get the hook. Yeah. Okay, great. Great comment. So, a couple of things here. You know, numerous teachers like Chogyam Trungpa, for example, like in Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, really talks about boredom as one of the great enemies of practice. And something that comes up around boredom is restlessness, which you may know is one of the five hindrances, you know, in Buddhism.
You can't feel restless, though.
Yeah. You didn't get there, yeah. What I'm struck by is how people do comment that at certain stages in practice, often people experience a lot of boredom. And it can be one of the greatest challenges to staying with it. When I think about what you're talking about, though, and when I think about the my own experience of deep practice and also people who are far along in the path, they don't really talk about that quality of blahness, if you will, as central to their experience. Because one, they feel increasingly animated by these very self-nourishing, as they flow through, wholesome motives toward other people, first. And second, they start accessing a joy and contentment and peacefulness that is self-renewing and very, very profound and satisfying. And so
peacefulness doesn't desire anything. It just stays. It's just, in other words, I have that peacefulness too.
Yeah, I'm making a distinction.
Yeah.
I'm making a distinction between a state where the mind, it's almost like, one way to think about it perhaps, and just not so much to talk about the specific for you, but to generalize it, is sometimes we get dragged willy-nilly into a state of mind that is kind of an advanced state. And then the point, though, is that on the other side of that state of mind, particularly as we really practice our way to get to that point in a more organic way, on the other side of that state of mind is, as I said, a very self-nourishing kind of loving orientation to other people in the whole world, as well as qualities of peacefulness and happiness and joy that are very rewarding. And so it's really okay. Actually, it's experienced as a great relief and a great joy that the mind is quite equanimous and even, you know. That's just what I would offer that for that. I think that, I think your question is exactly right. Where does this path lead, right? And usually we know that the next step at least is worth taking. You know, the next step of less emotional reactivity, the next step of greater control of our mind, the next step of greater kindness to ourselves and toward other people. That step seems worth taking. But when we look far down the road, particularly in a path like Buddhism, which is very stark and pulls no punches and doesn't let anybody off easily. You know, we ask ourselves, gee, what's the point? Where am I going? You know, am I just going to be a cipher, a zero, a void? And I think it's an absolutely legitimate question and a very important one because it goes to motivation, and motivation is critical. And I'll just say that the way I answer that question for myself is I ask myself, the people that I know personally who are farther along the path than I am, are they glad they did it? And what are they like? Right? And they're always glad they did it. And they seem more at ease in the world, more grounded, happier, more loving, wiser, with more access to profundity. Than I am, let's say, or have been, and I go, pretty good. So I'll just leave it at that. Okay, a few more questions or comments about mindfulness and what I've said tonight, right? The three attributes of mindfulness, and then these four supporting conditions, and then let's call it a wrap. Betsy.
Well, I have a little story then about mindfulness and your conditions. I can't remember all your words, and today I had a conversation with my mother and her doctor, and with the doctor, I wasn't mindful. I was just laser focused, and I thought I was mindful, but I wasn't. It was pinpoint, and I had to be there. And later in the day, I realized that wasn't mindful because I talked to my mom, and I was so agitated. I wanted her something from her. I wanted, what was that last two things you said?
Without longing or dejection.
Right. Well, I had longing, and I was dejected. She wouldn't get it together. She had very bad. They're going to stop her medication, and you know, it's over. And all of a sudden, a switch flipped, and I could feel my breath, and I could feel my, you know, you're aware of your awareness, and it was mindfulness. And it was sustained. I could listen to her. I didn't need it to be different than what it was. And I had just come from another place, and the phone conversation, and it was reaching out. It wasn't an internet, but it was reaching out right across. And I'm telling you, those vibes go right through a telephone to another person. And it was a beautiful mindfulness, maybe for a few minutes. And every single thing you said is needed, I think, to make it. And then there's that subtle awareness. It's just there. You're in a space. And
right.
You know it without knowing it. You never have to ask the question, and it's worth everything and anything of that this practice will lend itself to. I don't know if I put that right, but
well, thank you for your experience there.
And it's mindful.
Yeah, exactly. And it's if I could from it, it makes the point that mindfulness is a mode of being, And we can apply that mode of being to different things. We can be mindful of, but it's also, it's how we are with what's there, and then we can apply that to various objects of attention. You know, we can apply that to the sensations of the breath. We can apply that to all the cross currents going on in ourselves as we're dealing with an aging parent struggling with health care, right? I think it's useful to make a distinction between a mode of being and then how we apply that mode of being in different ways. And one application of this, of mindfulness, of this mode of being, is global self-awareness. You know, where there is a kind of global self-awareness, that's a mode, that's mindfulness applied to the totality of what one is experiencing at any moment in time. But that's not, of course, the only thing that one can be mindful of. Okay. Well, thank you for being so mindful for a potentially subtle and difficult topic. But I really think it's not so difficult, and I'll leave you with a couple thoughts, and then let's sit for 1 minute and end. I think it really works, just like you said, Betsy, to form an anchor. You know, that's a NLP term or hypnotic term, but we kind of anchor in our body what it feels like to be mindful. And words for me that are emotionally saturated actually really help, like gentle, dignified, present, intimate, you know, sinking into the bath, wide. I mean, there, bam, I'm there, you know. Just whatever works for you, it's great to find a word or a sense or an image that kind of pulls it all together for you. Deeper than the words, more fundamental, you know, thunk, right here and now. It kind of magnetizes you into your own way of being, your own doorway into being mindful. So let's rest there for the next minute or so. May our practice help free ourselves and others from suffering. And to be mindful myself of a very brief and very important announcement, if I may. I want to really thank the people who've come through with our refreshments here. You know,